From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Finally this week, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice appeared in Congress before the 9/11 Commission and the world. As court TV, it was alternately dull, contentious, and gripping.
Did you tell the president at any time prior to August 6th of the existence of al-Qaeda cells in the United States?
First, let me just make certain.
If you could just answer that question,
first,
because I only have a very limited...
I understand, Commissioner, but it's important that I also address...
This weekend, various assessments of Rice's effectiveness in fending off the charges of former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. But what about the overall impact of these televised hearings? Have they changed the media's and the public's view of the Bush administration, of the Congress? John Dean, former counsel to President Nixon, testified during the Watergate hearings, and he watched them closely, just as he's watched the 9/11 hearings. Mr. Dean, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
So could you compare and contrast these hearings with the Watergate hearings as a media event?
There's no question that the Watergate hearings were extensive. They were actually even protracted. There was massive media coverage. It was reality television before reality television. And it really was educational. And that was one of the aims of the committee, and later talking to Sam Dash about it. This is what they hoped to do. They built their case very slowly and then went public with it.
Sam Dash, of course, was chief counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee. And actually, he told us that he carefully staged the hearings as a detective story, beginning with the burglaries, then bringing out the accusers like yourself, and ending with the accused. Do you think that these recent hearings use that same structure?
To some degree, there was some similarity in the structure because Richard Clark had met with several members of the commission for, I think, something like 18 hours. They also had a number of documents that had been supplied. And in a sense, Richard Clark is the accuser. He's accusing Mr. Bush of not really being very vigilant about terrorism until after 9/11. Condoleezza Rice's role was to defend that.
If you look at the hearings as theater, certainly Rice's testimony was intended to be the climax. Did you get that sense of satisfaction as a viewer from watching it?
Well, I think she was a good witness theatrically. She's very eloquent and well-spoken, and she managed to sit there for almost 3 hours and say almost nothing. She knew how to play the game. She'd been carefully briefed. She couldn't have done what she did in the hearings in a courtroom. A judge would have held her in contempt if she'd have tried to go on those extended answers. And at one point, as you recall, Senator Kerry, Bob Kerry, said, "You're filibustering," and that's exactly what she was doing.
Since we have a point of disagreement, I'd like to have a chance to address it.
No. Actually, there's going to be, we have many points of disagreement, Dr. Clark. We'll have a chance to do in closed session. You can't, please don't filibuster me. Not fair.
During the Watergate hearings, they had as much time, as many hours as they needed to grill a witness. Here, they were only given 10 minutes. So as long as she filled that with some measure of verbiage, she would be safe.
And she knew how to play to the camera and force him back down. If this had been a closed hearing, he would have prevailed, and she would not have been able to embarrass him into letting her continue to filibuster. She knew that here was a commissioner couldn't be beating up on her and telling her to start answering the questions without looking like he was getting overly aggressive and being partisan when he was just trying to use his time effectively. So she prevailed, and it was the cameras that really enabled her to do that.
Once again, could you compare that with the way that the Watergate hearings were conducted?
There was no time limit. For example, I'd originally planned to go up and summarize my testimony in maybe a half hour on the first day of my appearance. Instead, they said, "No, we want you to read your testimony." So I had to read my testimony. It took 8 hours. With the 9/11 hearings, given the fact they were constrained, she was effectively able to use the time.
Here's what Sam Dash told us was the recipe for a satisfying viewing experience and also, I guess, a successful legal proceeding.
I knew exactly what my questions were going to be, and I knew exactly what the answers were going to be so that I could put it in a form that this would come out like a story. And I think it succeeded in the sense that the American people were glued to their television sets waiting for the next episode.
Were you glued to the TV set when watching the 9/11 hearings? Did it pay off for you?
No, by no means did it.
What do you think the principal lesson for the public has been so far?
Well, what I took away from the hearings is that this is an example of secrecy. This is an example of putting forward what appears to be an open statement of what's going on, when in fact it really is not. No new information came out. The only thing the public learned was the name that was on the briefing paper that apparently the Bush administration is now reluctantly going to make available.
The title that stated flatly that Osama bin Laden was looking to attack within the United States.
That's correct. There may have been some other nuances and details, and it's clear that because of the different position that Richard Clark and Condoleezza Rice are taking, I think the commission's going to sort this out and tell us what really is the truth.
They were interesting and unlikely main characters for this drama, I think. We didn't expect Condi to appear at all, and Richard Clark just seemed to emerge full-grown from the head of Zeus.
Isn't that what makes theater most interesting, when characters walk on you don't expect?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Dean, former counsel to President Richard Nixon. His new book is called Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush.
In a press conference Wednesday, we caught this exchange between a reporter and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
Aren't you having a more difficult time making the case that things are going well in Iraq?
Things we're trying to explain how things are going, and they're going as they are going. And we're here pointing out what's taking place in the country. Some things are going well, and some things obviously are not going well.
On Wednesday, that was an understatement. As the week wore on, the situation only got worse, with Shiite militias partially controlling three southern cities, Marines fighting house to house in the Sunni city of Fallujah, and foreign civilians being kidnapped by Iraqi militiamen. But Rumsfeld stayed on message through it all, downplaying the bad and emphasizing the good, as did his staffers at the Coalition Provisional Authority press office in Baghdad. On Thursday, we caught up with Washington Post correspondent Anthony Shadid in Nasiriyah. Shadid has been filing from Iraq for the past year, and this week won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. Anthony, congratulations.
Thank you.
According to the Associated Press, the coalition press office in Baghdad is led by Republican Party operatives and staffed largely by people with GOP ties. The New York Times noted that high-ranking British officials are concerned that, quote, events are orchestrated with the American political agenda uppermost in mind. Can you talk about your experience with the coalition information machine in Iraq, and in what ways that has hindered your reporting or just colored it?
I guess there's a couple things that strike me about my interaction with it over the past year. Obviously, there's an ideological component there. I mean, it's part of an administration that's very political and politically aware. I think that drives things less than the isolation that the CPA deals with. And I think that isolation at times is startling. You understand their isolation. I mean, it's a very precarious security situation here. But I think they have lacked an ability to get out, to get around, to sense what's going on in the street, to sense what's going on in other cities. And I think, you know, time and again, that's caught up with them, that they've been caught, unaware of the speed of events, the pace of events, like we've seen this week in just a matter of days.
Concerning the security situation, you are someone who spends very little time in press conferences and a lot pounding the pavement. There is increasing lawlessness throughout Iraq. Four American journalists were kidnapped for several hours earlier in the week, and a day later, a Japanese journalist was kidnapped. Is this affecting your ability to get to the story?
You know, it is. It's definitely more precarious now than it's ever been. And even when you talk to people, all they can think about is your safety. They're worried about, you know, the danger that you're putting yourself in. I think it's going to pose a real challenge to reporting here, because I think there's almost a reflexive, you know, reaction by journalists to harden themselves. And what I mean by that is, you know, possibly to have armed escorts, to fortify the places that they're working from. And while it's understandable, there's a risk in isolating ourselves from the story, and, you know, perhaps it's inevitable, but, you know, we do run the risk of falling into the same isolation that we may have criticized the CPA for, and not understanding how this story is changing and how it's moving on the ground.
On the flip side, there seems to be a growing reliance on reporters from Arab television stations who have become on-the-scene reporters by proxy because Western reporters simply can't safely get access to the story. What implications does that have, do you suppose?
some coverage is politicized. There's no question about it. And if it's in the context that might be different than the context that Western reporters are used to reporting in. That said, I think, you know, a lot of this is information, and information itself is useful. And, you know, we don't have a person in Najaf right now. We have our Iraqi reporter down there who's done a fantastic job. He's been able to get details. He's put himself into incredible, you know, dangerous situations. And we feel really lucky that we have him there. So I guess I right off just don't see any far-reaching implications of that. I think anytime you have secondhand information, it's less preferable than firsthand information. But we are reaching a point where it's too dangerous. It's parts of this country simply go into.
In your piece in Thursday's Washington Post, you wrote about the increasingly fuzzy line between civilians and combatants in Sadr City, the Baghdad slum, where so much fighting has been going on since last weekend.
You go into Sadr City and you realize the implications of what's ahead, perhaps. You know, I think the U.S. government often wants to personalize these conflicts. They're against one man, they're against Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden or Muqtada Sadr. But what we see in Sadr City is that it's not that easy for the people that are in that neighborhood. There's almost kind of a knee-jerk reaction to arresting clerics. It reminds people of Saddam's government. It's distasteful to them. I think when you see civilian casualties mount, we've seen more than 60 people killed there since Sunday. There's a sense that even if you don't have a lot of love for Muqtada Sadr, you have, you know, a certain affinity for your neighbors, basically, who are coming under fire. And that's where you see the nature of the opposition, I think, changing and becoming very fluid.
I want to talk to you about the language of reporting in a situation like this. As the nature of the combatants themselves is changing, seemingly before our eyes, does the language of your reportage change with it? Who's the enemy, and how do you describe them?
You know, that's an interesting question, because it's one thing that we really never understood fully, I think, is the nature of opposition to the U.S. occupation. I mean, I think we all felt it was driven by remnants of the government in the beginning, and there was a different component later with the suicide bombings. You know, now we're seeing in Fallujah what looks to be popular resistance at a certain level. And I think it's going to become more complex as time goes on, and I think it's not easy to put them into neat and tidy categories.
You know, I've always known that someday I would interview a war correspondent with a dog fight going on in the background, but I never expected it to be a fight between actual dogs.
They are loud dogs, I have to say.
Well, Anthony, thank you very much. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
Anthony Shadid covers Iraq for the Washington Post. He spoke to us from Nazaria. He is the winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting.
Coming up, why Iraqi journalists can't catch a break and how the most powerful pictures can obscure the real details of tragedy.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 3 weeks ago, three men working for the Arab satellite news channel Al Arabiya were at the scene of a rocket attack on a hotel waiting for permission to film. The coalition said no, and as they pulled out to leave, another car suddenly passed them trying to break through the U.S. Army barricade. Ahmed Abdul Qasim was driving the Al Arabiya news van. When he heard shots, he pressed hard on the gas pedal and sped himself and his colleagues to safety. At least he thought he had. When he was far enough away to slow down, he realized that both of his passengers were dead. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, as of Friday, 11 journalists have died in Iraq in 2004, all of them from the Middle East. Dan Murphy reports from Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's covered the story. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Al Arabiya is now considering legal action against the U.S. because of the death of those two newsmen.
That's correct. It's not just the death of the newsmen, it's the fact that the American report on it exonerated the soldiers involved, and there were enormous discrepancies between the driver who survived the attack's account of what happened and the official American account of what happened. Certainly it's the case that if you go to Al-Arabiya's offices now, there is a much greater anger towards the U.S. military and the U.S. government in general than there was before.
Arab journalists seem to be caught in the middle. You tell the story of a cameraman who was stringing for an Arab news outlet who was given a tip from insurgents who told him that they had just blown up a U.S. Humvee. He rushed to the scene. Can you describe what happened next?
Absolutely. He went out, you know, like a lot of these stringers out in difficult areas. He has a camera, he works alone, and he's paid to get great footage of the latest attacks. And very often that makes the news because that's what people are interested in seeing. So he rushes out to film it. The Americans on the scene are immediately suspicious. They think that he's gotten there too soon. And he gets questioned about how he knew that something had happened, and they think maybe these people have foreknowledge of the attacks. Eventually, he's allowed to leave, and he dispatches footage to Baghdad, where it can be distributed to a station. The 5 o'clock news update hour comes and goes, and for whatever reason, they didn't use that footage. And he got paid a visit by the guys that gave him a call, who were upset that their handiwork hadn't been on the air. They came into his place, and they had guns, and they threatened him.
What is the impact of being pressured from both sides on these journalists?
It's a sensitive subject, but I know that one large station has actually chosen not to use a lot of the good footage that it gets because of the allegations they've gotten from the coalition that they tend to know too much and that maybe they have foreknowledge of attacks. On the other side, in terms of the insurgents being upset with what you report or show footage of, I think it's very, very difficult for them to anticipate what's going to make those folks happy. So the Arab journalists say that they're trying to play it straight down the middle and try to convince everybody that they're neutral parties, just the way any other journalist would. But it's not clear to what extent they're succeeding in doing that.
We spoke about Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera as well, established news services that have been caught in between the two warring parties. Is this also true of the nascent Iraqi media?
Certainly, average Iraqi journalists will feel under threat. The interesting thing is there have been a number of attacks in recent months on translators and drivers and fixers for Western journalists. These are people that are Iraqis that help foreigners get the story here. There's been 3 or 4 people like that killed in, let's say, the past month or 6 weeks, and they've clearly been targeted by insurgents. This category of people I'm talking about working with the Western journalists work in Baghdad a lot, just like we all do, but I'll come home to my safe compound, you know, hotel with protection around it at night, and these guys go back and they live in their Iraqi neighborhood, and people that want to do them harm know the street that they live on, and that's how they get targeted.
Right. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dan Murphy reports from Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor.
Jim Lewis has always believed in photography. The journalist and novelist has often written about photography and has done quite a bit himself, most memorably at the scene of a horrific atrocity last summer in Congo. There was a time he believed that such awful pictures, pictures such as emerged from the murder of 4 Americans in Fallujah 2 weeks ago, were crucial for documenting the horrors of war. But no longer. The Fallujah images and the journalistic hand-wringing over them prompted Lewis to write this week on Slate.com why graphic documentation of violence doesn't necessarily help anyone understand the story.
Part of the problem with printing photographs like this is that they tend to strip away any of the context which would help anybody actually understand the story. You know, what did these guys look like before this happened? You know, what were they traveling in? What part of town were they in? How many people actually were there? All of that gets lost in the grisly sight of these bodies hanging from a bridge. I just think that to the extent that it's the function of journalism to explain things to people, photographs like this actually do less explaining than one might otherwise wish.
Your thinking on the subject changed based on your own work in Eastern Congo.
Mm-hmm.
You were there almost a year ago. Tell me about your experience.
I was based in a little town called Bunia, and we went out of town one day, myself and another reporter and a photographer, up into the hills outside of town where we had heard that there had been a massacre, and we got there, and there was. And there was nobody else there except for the people who had died, and they had been not just killed but dismembered and in a particularly horrific way. And after I had finished sort of taking my notes, and the people I was with had other work to do, and I didn't know what to do, and I was just kind of standing around and took out my camera and took a lot of photographs.
So what you had in your camera was something shocking, something extraordinary. At what point did you know that your mind had changed and that whatever these pictures were, they were not something to be shared with a mass audience?
I would be talking to friends and family and people that I worked with and trying to explain what was going on in the Congo and what I had seen, and I would show them these photographs along with others, and I just found that they got in the way of trying to tell the story I wanted to tell, and that, in fact, rather than clarifying the story, the shock of the photographs had a tendency to derail both my telling of the story and other people's understanding of it.
In your piece in Slate, you referred to a story where a man killed himself and that the suicide was captured by the security cameras in his building and then somehow found their way to an internet site that traded in shocking video footage and so forth. And the mother of the victim, I believe, was beside herself wondering how her son's death could turn into a sort of pornography.
What I mean by pornography is just that the fact that such a thing exists on film at all is often so surprising to people or so shocking or exciting or whatever it may be that it tends to overwhelm the information that the pictures would otherwise actually convey.
Now, I saw the Fallujah pictures when they were first published and aired, and they were genuinely horrifying. But I must say, I was not as moved by them as I was by a single line in a single Wire story about one of the kidnappings in Iraq. It was of a Jerusalem resident who evidently also has a United States driver's license. And the kidnappers, to prove that they had this guy in custody, were showing his passport and his U.S. driver's license and his supermarket frequent shopper's card. Mm-hmm. And the very quotidian nature of a supermarket frequent shopper's card was so humanizing for me that I got very choked up. Far more than I did from the most graphic pictures emerging from the war.
I have much the same sorts of reactions. I used to think that only a photograph can really accurately convey what goes on in a war, and that anything less than absolute explicitness would amount to a kind of whitewashing. And I think, in fact, that's simply not true. A well-written paragraph can be just as informative and just as horrifying and just as touching, but doesn't run the same kinds of risks.
Well, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Lewis is a novelist living in Austin, Texas. His article, Front Page Horror, appeared last week on Slate.com.
It's been 10 years since the Rwandan genocide, 100 days of ruthless slaughter that left perhaps a million dead. Mostly, the outside world sat that one out. But in commemoration of the anniversary, this month a flood of memorials, specials, documentaries, and feature films are filling the ether. Now it seems the West is ready to remember. But 2 years ago, we interviewed Nick Hughes, a photojournalist who was among the first to try and convey the experience in a way that people might comprehend. Hughes had already made many documentaries of the horror, but this time he and his co-producer Eric Cabera, who lost 32 family members to the genocide, wanted to find a new way to tell the story. So they hired witnesses, Tutsis and Hutus, as actors, and created a love story to put a human face on the slaughter. The result was 100 days.
Get rid of women and their baby rats. Don't leave any rats for the future. The time for work is now. What we have waited for is happening. Hutu power! Power! Hutu power!
Director Nick Hughes joins us now from Rwanda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you're a documentary cameraman who's covered the war in Rwanda. You have hours and hours of powerful footage of the genocide. Why did you decide to tell the story of such a dramatic historical event as a fictional drama?
I worked on so many documentaries after the genocide. And in many ways, a documentary is the best way to tell the history of such an enormous event. But documentaries about Rwanda aren't watched. And if they are watched, they're watched by people who already know and have assumptions about Rwanda. And therefore, you're preaching to the converted. And 100 Days is made to explain in a dramatic form, to explain what happened in Rwanda to an audience who has no interest in Rwanda.
two of the most important characters in 100 Days are Josette and Baptiste, both young lovers. Was this lover subplot a way of drawing people in?
You know, love is a universal theme. The audience, even if they're in Tokyo or Toronto, can immediately relate to the hopes and fears of that couple.
I'd like to share with you my reaction to the movie. It seemed to me that when you cleaved closest to the actual events, it had the most impact. And when you moved off to the plots that you had imposed to attract the audience, because the actors were frankly rather wooden, it was when my mind began to wander.
Indeed. I mean, none of the actors are professional actors, but they are Rwandan, and they were portraying something under whose shadow they lived and through which they had lived. Maybe the film fails on this, and maybe we should have had very professional actors, but they weren't going to be Rwandan. Some people find the acting wooden. Some people find it, because they're Rwandan, acting their own story, twice as powerful.
I was fascinated by your use of the extraneous characters who came through, the UN soldiers, the journalists. You have journalists, people holding cameras, just as you yourself did during the actual genocide, scattered all through.
Just hold on, hold on. Catherine! Just wait right there.
Who are they?
They were friends. Mr. Cabell was not liked. He was in an opposition political party.
Is that why they killed him?
I don't know, maybe. I don't know.
Who
maybe
killed him?
I can't tell. I don't know.
They're generally in the way. They're irrelevant. They're taking no moral stand, and they have no impact on what's going on around them. It's as if they were dropped from the moon.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly what happened. You had UN soldiers from the West. You had aid workers. You had expats. You had journalists. All of them betrayed the Rwandan people. The media took absolutely no part in the genocide, in it exposing it to the international community. It brushed it off with cliches, caricatures. The aid workers, 99% of them, just got on the plane and left. The expats just left their servants to be slaughtered and evacuated while they evacuated their dogs. And the UN, who were there, brought in to protect the Tutsi population, to keep the peace, just ran away. And there's a worrying thing, I think, at the moment, that the, particularly in the media, in film, in documentaries, in books, is that there is now a sort of myth-making about Westerners in Rwanda, that somehow they suffered. They didn't suffer at all. I didn't lose anybody there, you know, compared to someone who lost their entire family, generations slaughtered in a month.
It's clear that you don't have much respect for those characters who wander through your story. You don't pay much attention to them at all. And yet you yourself, when you were there, videotaped a machete-wielding man beating a woman and her daughter, pleading for their lives, and it was broadcast all over the world in 1994. Do you think it did nothing?
Well, it was something very, very small. I mean, I didn't save anybody. I didn't put my camera down and save any children, and nor did anybody else, and nor did those people who sat at home and watched those two women being murdered, watching their television in Europe or America. Nothing happened. There was no great outcry for something to be done.
In an effort to tell your story in a way that would be popular and not cheapen or distort it, you tried to cleave a sort of middle course. You put in a love story, but you offered no redemption for any of the characters. There isn't anybody who is saved. There isn't anybody who isn't irreparably damaged. Here's a clip of a little girl talking to a UN soldier in front of one of the mass graves.
Did you see what happened?
They put all the Tutsis in the ground and in the pit latrines.
Did you know them?
My friend Etienne is there with his whole family.
If he was your friend, don't you miss him?
No, he belongs in a pit latrine. It's natural. He was a Tutsi.
Given that the story ends on a note of absolute despair, is there any technique, including a love story, that you think would be able to keep the audience there?
There's nothing positive about genocide. You can't come out with some glimmer of hope. Genocide is all negative. It is all dark and evil. And the suffering that people go through is beyond imagination. But if there's some understanding and some sympathy, and there's some belief that Rwandans were human beings amongst an international audience, then that's a great step.
Nick, now that you made the film that you wanted to make, do you think you can find a way to forgive yourself a little bit?
Well, it's not really a matter of forgive.
I guess what I mean is,
yeah,
it's obvious that you came away with an enormous burden and a sense of responsibility that you don't feel you fulfilled and that the rest of the Western community in Rwanda certainly didn't fulfill. And you made this film. So my question is can you leave it alone now?
Well, the film gives me an opportunity to speak about Rwanda, but I don't get the opportunity to go back and stop by the side of the road and pick up a child who's going to be murdered by the Interahamwe and take him out of the country to safety. And nor does anybody else get that opportunity to do that again. And nobody said anything about stopping it happening next time. So, no, I don't think there is anything really to feel positive about or redeemed about. Not at all. The genocide is the opposite of redemption. There is no redemption. You can't go back. Those people are dead, and it will happen again.
Nick, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Photojournalist and documentarian Nick Hughes. His film, 100 Days, premiered in 2002.
Up next, waxing poetic about cars and unmasking the WAG.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the annual Pulitzer Prizes were awarded, and among the many worthy recipients, the unlikeliest was Dan Neal, car critic for the Los Angeles Times. Unlikely because the Criticism Award always goes to critics of the arts, except for the 1 year it was awarded to a media critic, but also because auto reviewers tend to be regarded with a certain suspicion, since most newspapers depend on the goodwill of car dealership advertisers. But Dan Neal is the Oscar Wilde of auto reviewers. In his columns, cars serve ably as metaphors for our culture. To wit,
why do I like the Benz wagon? For me, whose personal life has often resembled the Save My Baby skit with the clown fireman, the station wagon connotes a settled domesticity, peace and stability, devoutly to be wished. Singledom has certainly lost its luster. There's also something deeply appropriate about wagons. They are big enough to enclose my life, but not so big as to suggest a fear of something left behind, as huge SUVs seem to do. Station wagons are kind of like SUVs after years of therapy. So I find myself doing is kind of identifying not so much the mechanical deficiencies and surpluses of a particular car, but how it fits into people's lives, what it says about them, and whether it says something you would like it to say about you. For instance, this week I'm driving a Chevy SSR pickup. It's kind of a postmodern hot rod pickup truck. It's like a pickup truck from Toontown. I mean, you feel ridiculous driving it. So I feel that it's one of those vehicles that you would drive once, park, and sell.
Now, as you just described, you seem to love cars, but individual cars can frequently leave you cold. And that's difficult, many people say, for car critics, because auto advertising is so important. And, of course, there's a story floating around about you. Could you tell us about the last column you wrote for the Raleigh News and Observer back in 1997?
Sure. I actually worked in classified advertising when I was working for the News Observer, and I produced an advertorial auto section, and I wrote the column for them. I didn't ask anybody, and nobody read it behind me. It just appeared in the paper. You know, my column was really crazy, and this one time I wrote a story about having intimate congress in the back of Ford Expedition. I said at the time, you know, we both had our seatbelts on. It was safe sex. And actually, they didn't think it was that funny at all. So my boss called me in and said, okay, that's it. You are on super, super double Dutch probation. Basically, he was saying to me that I was going to have to be vetted by the advertising boss, and this I declined to do. And so after a few months of passive resistance, they fired me. And by the way, the News and Observer, on the other side of the church-state wall, the news side, is a very, very honorable and respectable, you know, operation. At issue, though, is whether or not newspapers who produce these advertorial sections, you know, whether their hands are clean on this issue overall.
We spoke to Keith Bradshaw, who's the author of the book High and Mighty about SUVs, mm-hmm. and he says that among critics, auto reviewers are the most likely to be compromised by the industry they cover, that they're often quitting their jobs to take industry PR jobs for big bucks. Do you think that's true, and did that ever tempt you?
It is absolutely true. The entire environment is incestuous. They introduce new cars. They fly journalists in and put them up at really nice hotels and, you know, treat them to experiences that they could never possibly in a million years. They wouldn't even be allowed in these hotels ordinarily. You know, then they let them drive the cars and then they go away, you know, and that's not supposed to affect their judgment. What's surprising is not that it does affect their judgment, but that so often it doesn't affect their judgment. I forget who said it, but some politician said, if you can't take their money and vote against them anyway, you're no damn good. but it is a compromised business, and it is also true that newspapers are under a great deal of revenue pressure on this score. And so, yeah, a favorable editorial slash advertorial content is often created to satisfy that need.
Which you frequently don't provide.
Almost never. I'm really ornery.
Does the industry hate you?
No. No, the manufacturers are tremendous about this. You know, like General Motors, right? You know, this thing that I'm driving that's just an awful vehicle, this SSR. They know that, you know, I may hate that vehicle, but I may like something else. And I think it's worth it to them.
I think you're too important in Los Angeles for them to lean on you too hard.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe, but my importance is a relatively recent phenomenon.
You mean in the last week?
Yep, and I expect that there will be diminishing returns. I won't be getting the best table at Spago's next week.
Congratulations, Dan Neal.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you, Brooke.
Dan Neal is automobile critic for the Los Angeles Times and recipient of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism.
A few years ago, a group of researchers at the University of California at Berkeley were fed up with widespread academic dishonesty. So they invented a technology that could finger students who were using the internet to craft cut-and-paste term papers. That software, called Turnitin, works by matching up a string of 8 or more words with original sources to catch the copycats. It is very popular in the halls of academe. Now there's a new professional-grade version of Turnitin known as iThenticate, beloved by lawyers because its data-sifting power quickly spots white-collar thieves with sticky fingers for intellectual property. So what would happen if this software were applied to journalists? John Barry is the president and founder of iParadigms LLC, which developed iThenticate, and is here to tell us. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bob.
I'm going to go confessional on you for a moment. When I was in high school, and this is a shameful episode, and I apologize to all involved, but everybody else in my German class had to write an essay on Beethoven, and almost to a student, they went to the World Book Encyclopedia and plagiarized the essay therein about Ludwig von Beethoven. I alone in this entire class had the foresight and intellectual rigor to plagiarize from the Grolier Encyclopedia, which was much more obscure, and they all got caught and I didn't. And I live with that guilty memory to this day. Is there an equivalent these days of being able to go to the more obscure source to cheat from?
There is so much information on the internet, from, you know, World Book Encyclopedia to the encyclopedia you may have taken from, to, you know, the most obscure books that you could even imagine. And interestingly enough, even if those primary sources are not on the internet, so many people have taken from sources like that, incorporated that into their work, posted that work on the internet, that maybe our technology really doesn't find the book that you've taken your material from, but it's found another source that's quoted that book, which then ultimately leads the faculty member or the editor or you name it to the original source that you cheated from.
Let's talk about the Hartford Courant. One of its op-ed contributors, who was the president of Central Connecticut State University, Richard Judd, had plagiarized from several sources for an opinion piece he wrote for that paper. Tell me the Judd story.
The journalist from the Hartford Courant gave us a call, and she said, well, one of the stories that we published in our newspaper has been found to contain some factual inaccuracies and some possible plagiarism, and we're doing a follow-up piece regarding that story. And I said, well, I'd be happy to answer your questions, but you may be interested, just for the heck of it, to run this piece through our Authenticate system just to see if you've missed any bits and pieces. She took us up on our offer and ran it through the system, and the thing lit up like a Christmas tree. And that led to the resignation of Mr. Judd from Central Connecticut State University.
I'm a columnist in my other job, and what would happen if I randomly took a paragraph from my column or one of my columns in its entirety and ran it through Authenticate? Is there any chance that you'd get a false positive? I mean, I know I haven't stolen from anybody since high school. Is there a chance that some random assemblage of words would trigger a false accusation?
The probability of stringing the same 16 words together by chance as somebody else has strung together is less than 1 in a trillion. It's just not going to happen. And the probability of stringing, let's say, the same paragraph together somebody else has by chance is on the order of our sun exploding. Our technology will not begin to flag anything until we see at least 8 contiguous words matching another source.
In the wake of the Jason Blair scandal and USA Today and so forth, many news organizations have declared publicly that they're going to be more vigilant. Is that enough alone to deter plagiarism, or is the need for Authenticate or similar digital watchdogs an absolute necessity?
The addition of other human editors, the addition of ombudsmen, the addition of a whole warehouse of people screening articles is not going to make a dent in this problem. It won't deter anybody from committing the same acts. And in my humble opinion, what the New York Times has done is essentially set themselves up for another Jason Blair incident. Again, this is a digital problem, and it really can only be addressed by some type of digital solution.
How many news clients do you have at the moment vetting their own reporters?
As I mentioned earlier, the Hartford Courant is really the first large newspaper that has signed up for Authenticate.
This time next year, how many do you think you'll have?
The majority of them.
All right. Well, John, thank you very much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
John Barry is the president and founder of iParadigms LLC, which created and markets Authenticate. Last month, Toby McDaniel of the Springfield, Illinois State Journal Register was writing about a controversial city tax increase. One passage in his column read as follows. One wag doesn't think Alderman went overboard on the tax hike. Get real, he quips. $7 million won't patch all the potholes. Oh, those devilish wags. They're so waggish. And not just in central Illinois. From the New York Times to the London Times, from the South China Morning Post to the Kentucky Jewish Post and Opinion, from Air Safety Week to Hot Rod, one wag is among the most quoted personalities in journalism.
A wag is the fat guy at the desk next to you.
Gene Weingarten, while reasonably trim himself, is that fat guy. Resident Washington Post funny man whose various one-liners have more than once found their way into other people's stories. Because he's the humor columnist, free to crack wise unimpeded, he needn't resort to blind quoting. But other journalists are less at liberty to associate themselves with zingers, lest they compromise their objectivity or poison the well with the sources getting zinged. Rita Zekas, for instance, entertainment writer for the Toronto Star, has quoted one wag 28 times over the past 15 years.
Yes, I have.
there a code for one specific wag. I'm not going to attribute it to him, so I made him one wag. He's one wag.
A.K.A. Rob Salem, Toronto's Star TV critic and Zekas' longtime boyfriend. I understand you are one wag.
Busted at last.
You've been outed, man.
Well, yes, sadly it's true.
But the story does not end here, because contrary to Gene Weingarten's assertion, there is no reason to assume that one wag is always the fat man or the boyfriend or one of the cynical boys and girls on the bus. Often enough, it is the reporter himself laundering his own witticisms through the attribution to an anonymous supposed third party.
Journalists are like the eunuch in the harem.
Jeffrey Dvorkin is NPR's ombudsman.
You know, we have all of the responsibility and none of the pleasures. So every once in a while, if we're allowed to be waggish, I think it satisfies our instincts to be amusing as well as informative. I've said it myself.
Mind you, Dvorkin is the listening public's in-house advocate on matters of journalistic behavior, and he fesses up. That's partly because he is an honest man who well understands the challenges facing reporters in the field, and partly because he is a Canadian, a foreigner to our shores, and therefore infected with dangerous foreign ideas. In Canada, a database search reveals one wag is saying and quipping and wryly observing just everywhere. The National Post, Hamilton Spectator, Edmonton Sun, Vancouver Sun, Montreal Gazette, Regina Leader Post, Ottawa Citizen, Calgary Herald, and Rita Zekas' Toronto Star, Jeffrey Dvorkin.
It's a funny Canadianism, and I think originally a Britishism, that has crept into the language, at least in those parts of the Commonwealth that still call the Queen our Queen.
One of the things about this British Empire, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
UPI editor-in-chief Martin Walker believes one wag has his origins on Fleet Street, where historically reporters have been devilish, ruthless, and often too drunk to remember who quipped what. In fact, Walker's quoted one wag himself.
At least once. On occasion, we've all felt that the joke was just so good it had to be shared. It's one of those very useful phrases like, when one has just arrived in some riot-torn city and you're on your way from the airport in a taxi and you're interviewing a taxi driver, you will talk about local observers said.
In other words, a half-truth, if a fairly benign one. The Washington Post's Gene Weingarten.
You're talking as though this is some sort of journalistic sin. We're telling the truth. Is the person saying, as one wag who is not myself said? I believe that it is a sin so negligible, so minuscule, that it doesn't exist.
That gets to one last thing about one wag. The caustic hilarity so compelling as to justify journalistic, let's say, sleight of hand, is usually, not especially, you know, hilarious. A month ago, after Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin toned down his previous outrage at a scandal occurring under his predecessor, the Toronto Globe and Mail's Rod Mickleberg was moved to quote one wag.
Quote, it's the beginning of his post-mad-as-hell tour, quipped one media wag, referring to the anger Mr. Martin displayed in the days immediately after a sensational report by Auditor General Sheila Fraser revealed the extent of the sponsorship scandal. Pretty good quip, I thought.
Yeah, just let me catch my breath. What if I assert that the elaborate qualification and explanation of the quote in the subsequent clauses kind of took some of the impact from its pithiness?
You Yanks, get a healthcare system. It's a good, strong, powerful, funny line, and I'm sticking with it.
Quipped, one wag. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen our engineer. We had help from Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
As one wag who is not myself said.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.